Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today we have a couple of public hearings and a number of work sessions that are set up. Because of the workload of the various senators that are involved in some of these different bills, what I'm going to be doing is opening and recessing some of the public hearings so they can get their testimony on the record, and then we'll be coming back and taking other testimony at that time. With that, I'm going to start with opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 846. And Council, why don't you give us an overview?
Chair, Senate Bill 846 comes to you from Senator Bates. It requires a court, after finding someone guilty except for insanity, to determine the maximum sentence the person received had the person been convicted in offense, and doing so comply with the statutory mandated sentence as Measure 11 or sentencing guidelines. As Chair, members of the committee, currently the length this person spends under the supervision of the Psychiatric Security Review Board depends on the classification of the crime as an A, B, or C felony or misdemeanor.
All right,
so, for example, if someone's convicted of a B felony, they can stay either in the hospital or under the supervision of the PSRB for 10 years.
All right, so let me just put it on the record. What we're going to do is we're opening this up. We're going to take some dialogue. Nothing will be moving today, absolutely not. And we will reassess what, if anything, we're going to try to do during the next 3 days. But at this point, I want to at least get the information going, getting some dialogue. So, Senator Bates, Al, why don't you come on up? We'll take your testimony, and as I've told everyone, we'll probably be breaking after that one unless I have another member that wants to speak about this particular bill.
Senator Brzezinski, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, let me first introduce myself. I'm Senator Alan Bates from District 3, Southern Oregon, and I'm bringing you Senate Bill 846. Now, I want to start by saying that I'm always uncomfortable coming in front of judiciary. This is not where I have a comfort zone. I'm a physician, and I'm bringing this bill to you from a point of view as a physician and a senator. This is from a point of view of health care. The juju you guys do in this committee and bring to us, and we talk about in caucus, and I usually vote for, always seem to vote for, is something that sometimes I wonder what you've done. It's very close to nuclear physics for me, and I know just enough about it to be dangerous. So I'm going to present this to you primarily from the point of view of the mental health system and from my position in Ways and Means. We're talking about significant financial issues for the state. I also want to make it very clear, which I hope my testimony will do, we're not talking about opening up the floodgates at the state hospital to endanger the public in any way from individuals who could be dangerous to themselves or others. But we have a significant problem there with people who are essentially incarcerated in that facility who should not be in that facility. It's not appropriate for them as far as their mental health is concerned. The treatment of that mental health, nor are they truly a danger to themselves or others. It is a complex and difficult situation, and because of the complexity of it and the difficulty of it, I am going to stick very carefully to a prepared statement I have, which you have before you also. I normally don't like to sit and read a statement to you in the committee because you can read for yourselves. I quite understand that. But I want to get this on the record very, very carefully. Take what questions I can from you, knowing that there's others in the room who can probably answer some of your questions better than I can. So, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would like to start my testimony.
Please.
As co-chair of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, we are looking at ways to improve services while making deep budget cuts. And as a primary care physician who has worked on health care reform for 25 years, I'm also working on legislation that incorporates the November 2008 recommendations of the Oregon Health Plan Board. One such recommendation is the expansion of the Oregon Health Plan, and another is the integration of physical health and mental health services to increase access to patient care, improve outcomes, and reduce inefficiency and cost. The Health Fund Board also recommended that we can begin to achieve these goals by expanding community mental health services. And about the same time, November 2008, the Public Consulting Group of Boston, Massachusetts, completed its assessment of Oregon mental health delivery system. This was a report that we asked for through the Ways and Means process. Senator Carter and I asked for this evaluation of our local community health systems. The findings. In the past 10 years, programmatic and funding changes in Oregon have resulted in decreased access to community-based mental health services. This has resulted in increases in the census at the state psychiatric hospitals, increased the number of individuals involved with the criminal justice system who have mental health diagnoses, and increases in the use of emergency rooms for reasons associated with mental health issues. I can personally attest to the latter. This situation is not clinically advisable, cost-effective, nor financially sustainable. This report recommends that eligibility to services through the Oregon Health Plan be expanded and funding for community services be increased. The problem with these recommendations is that there is no money, especially in this budget climate, to fund community mental health services at a greater level than it presently is. Following a series of meetings with the Department of Corrections, the Department of Human Services, including Addictions and Mental Health, and the Oregon State Hospital, and members of the PSRB, and consultation with judges, clinicians, and advocates, it came to my attention that there is a population of misdemeanants and felons who perpetuated non-person crimes that spend more time committed at the Oregon State Hospital than they would ever spend in jail or prison if found guilty of the crime they committed. It costs roughly $200,000 per year in general fund dollars. There's no assistance from the federal government here. $200,000 per year in general fund dollars to keep a patient in the state hospital versus $25,000 to $28,000 to house them in our state prison system, and even less to provide them with what we call wraparound community mental health services. Wraparound community health services are those services that an individual get that include housing, making sure they take care of medications, make sure they're in a safe and secure situation, and in some cases even helping them with work. In addition to being morally wrong, this glitch in the criminal justice system is draining monies from general fund that could and should be used to finance a robust community health system in the state of Oregon. Additional information about this issue came to my attention when Judge James R. Hargraves, the governor's special master, filed his final report in the Oregon State Hospital transformation on February 23, 2009, just this last month. Judge Hargraves says at page 7, "One important consideration that I am sure is a driver for the use of the hospital is a lack of other treatment facilities or treatment providers in the community. I have no doubt that if reasonable alternatives to the hospital were available, judges and attorneys could be convinced to look at these local resources for many of these minor cases. This belief is supported by conversations I've had with judges, prosecutors, and defense counsels in several counties." He goes on to say on page 10, "One other likely consequence of failure to immediately deal with the issue of community beds for forensic and civil commitment patients is that when the new hospital comes online in 2010, this is the one we're talking about in Junction City, it will be completely full from day one and there will be no mechanism available to deal with the fact that there will be no room to take in new patients. In reality, it may already be too late to avoid this problem. Even if sites could be immediately found and planning begun for new facilities to bring the already funded beds in line, it seems doubtful these beds would be ready by the time the new hospital opens." Let me give you some personal experience. There have been many times when I'm in an emergency room at Rogue Valley Medical Center in Medford, Oregon, and I have a patient who has had a psychotic break. The patient doesn't know who he is, where he is, or what's going on. We have a ward there for them. We call it 2 North. If all the beds there are full, I will commonly call up to Portland, over to Bend, up to Roseburg. No longer can I call Roseburg. They've closed their beds down now. And try to find a bed for that patient and transfer that patient in the middle of the night to a bed. We can't send them straight to the mental hospital, the state mental hospital, for legal reasons. And often there's no bed there anyway. We have to hold them at another facility until a bed becomes available. We are jammed and we're getting our capacity reduced. We need a better way of handling these patients. I often also get a call when I'm at Rogue Valley from Portland or from Bend saying, "Do you have a bed available?" And we are moving people around in ambulances in the middle of the night who are mentally ill. This is not a system that's working well. Judge Hargraves, appointed as the governor's special master, came as a result of the United States Department of Justice's investigation of conditions and practices at the Oregon State Hospital, pursuant to the civil rights of institutionalized persons. The January 2008 findings directed the hospital to correct many deficiencies, one of them being discharge planning within the limitations of court-imposed confinement and public safety. and I want to reinforce public safety. We are not talking about endangering the public with any change here. The DOJ has tasked the state of Oregon with actively pursuing the appropriate discharge of patients and guaranteeing that patients receive services in the most integrated, appropriate setting that is consistent with their needs. Specifically on page 48 in paragraph number 4, we are to ensure that professional judgments about the most integrated setting appropriate to meet each patient's needs are implemented and that appropriate aftercare services are provided that meet the needs of the patient in the community.
These kind of issues, by the way, are not unique to Oregon.
The Department of Justice has taken over several mental health facilities in other states to force these changes. We do not want that to happen in our state. We are rapidly changing our methods and treatment at Oregon State Hospital as quickly as we can. The cost, by the way, is significant. I hope I've made it perfectly clear to you that I am not suggesting that we open the floodgates and release the residents of the state hospital. What I am suggesting is that we take a close look at how we are treating a portion of this population. When I was meeting with Richard Harris of AMH, he drew the diagram below to illustrate that the segment of the population housed in our state mental hospital and our state prisons that this legislation is meant to affect. And I won't go through that with you right now. You can obviously check that later. Given this background information, Senate Bill 846 was intended to address four main issues in the law. Change computation time that a person is committed on a finding of GEI or fitness to proceed for a felony based on the maximum true sentence for the crime as determined under sentencing guidelines matrix. Reduce time or resources expended on nonviolent misdemeanors. Distinguish between those involving physical harm to other persons and crimes, Class A's, and all other misdemeanors. Only Class A crimes can utilize services of state hospital. Establish criteria to be followed by judges, prosecutors, and attorneys to determine whether a defendant meets the statutory criteria for being found GEI without a jury trial. There is currently no such criteria in statute. Direct the PSRB and the Oregon State Hospital to develop a common set of criteria with common definitions or measurements for both the hospital and the PSRB to use in selecting patients for release. Does this bill drafted by the Legislative Council appropriately address these issues without unintended consequences? I fear not. I am here today to tell you that I am not married to this legislation as drafted. However, I do intend to find a working resolution to fairly and effectively treat the mentally ill without relying on an antiquated asylum-based system and to divert the savings to develop alternative care services within the mental health system in Oregon. If you are unable to vote for Senate Bill 846 out of committee, I ask that you instead create and staff a work group that reports back to the legislature in February 2010 with a bill for a law that encompasses the four criteria set out above. We don't need another report. We need a law. We need a change in the law. Finally, in closing, I will offer an amendment that any such law include language similar to ORS 410.052 as follows. The State of Oregon finds that within the budgetary constraints, it is appropriate that savings in the Oregon State Hospital allocations be reallocated to alternative care services within the mental health system in Oregon. In other words, shift these huge costs to mental health hospital back into community services where we can, first off, prevent unnecessary admissions to the hospital. Secondarily, allow people to come back to the communities in a safe setting, not only for them, but for the public. That concludes my comments.
All right.
There may be questions I can't answer for you. If I can't, there's others who I think are more qualified to do so.
All right. Let's just put everything in time frame. We have until about 10. I'm not sure how many members are going to be able to stay after that. So I expect this issue is going to be ongoing. And so do you have any questions at this point for Senator Bates? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members.
All right, we're going to recess 8:46 at this point. I'm going to open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 974.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 974 excludes hookah bar from the definition of smoke shop for the purposes of the Indoor Clean Air Act. It defines hookah bar as a business at which customers pay to smoke tobacco from a communal pipe. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Lori Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdalewood Village, and Fairview, and I'm here before you supporting Senate Bill 974. Last legislative session, we passed a ban on indoor smoking in restaurants and bars with Senate Bill 571. However, a loophole through the smoke shop exemption is existing, and this bill is going to try to close that up. Smoke shops were intended to be a place where people could come in and have informed choice, so that they could sit and try different flavors or different types of tobacco products. In 2007, we had four hookah bars, at least licensed hookah bars, and now we have 11. So it is growing, and it is targeting the 18 to 21-year-olds. Hookah is a communal pipe, and I had never known what a hookah was until one business opened in Rockwood. So I have a picture of one on the back page of my testimony for you, so that in case you don't know what they are, you can see what they are. This activity, I feel, as a public health nurse, is exposing people to high levels of carcinogenic chemicals and nicotine. Nicotine's a highly addictive drug. According to a report by the World Health Organization, the smoke that emerges from a water pipe contains numerous toxic chemicals, and they cause lung cancer, respiratory disease, and adverse effects during pregnancy.
All right, I'm going to ask you to hang on. Someone's got a cell phone in here. I need you to please turn it off. That's the second time I've heard it. If anyone else has theirs turned on, please turn them off, or you can go outside. Thank you. Go ahead.
If you look at the water pipe, you have to have a heat source. If you look at the water pipe at the head, there's either coal or wood chips that are put at the top. Then there's usually an aluminum foil, perforated aluminum foil, that separates that with the tobacco, which is usually moist or and has various flavors. When you suck in on the mouthpiece, you create a vacuum, and then it draws all of the smoke products and down through the water and up through the pipe, and that's how it works. So it isn't just the nicotine that's addictive, and you're also getting byproducts from the wood chips and the briquettes or whatever is used as your heat source. They're highly addictive and I feel highly dangerous. It's interesting that those who work in hookah bars are exposed to the same amount of secondhand smoke that an employee in a restaurant or bar would be exposed to, while also inhaling smoke from the fuel. And so we have to realize there's two different things here, and both pose, I feel, a very serious health risk. From a legal point of view, it shouldn't matter whether workers voluntarily submit themselves to the dangers of secondhand smoke. Also, we've talked about nicotine, and I do want to also put on the record that we did not intend the law that we passed in 2007, we did not intend for these hookah lounges, hookah bars, to proliferate. That wasn't the intent of having these smoke shops. So I think that I will end my testimony here, and although I do want to point out one other thing, this does cater, at least the one in Rockwood, to 18 and 21-year-olds, and I did visit it, and the owner of the hookah lounge is a very nice young man, and I enjoyed talking with him and he explaining to me what the business was all about. But I want you to realize that over 82% of Oregon adults begin smoking before the age of 21, and I also want you to know that adults try, those addicted to tobacco try at at least 6 times to try to quit as an adult. So even though you're not thinking about that between the ages of 18 and 21, we have so many that are trying to quit smoking. Plus, it is a great deterrent on our health system, because we are paying so much money for those who are diseases and chronic diseases resulting from the smoking from smoking.
Thank you. Questions? Senator?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator, for bringing this bill forward. I spent a good chunk of the month of December in the Middle East and saw, they call them shisha in Egypt. So there were shisha bars, and it is part of the culture. A lot of predominantly men, but I did see women as well. But I had a question for you. Have you had a chance to look at either of the amendments? And I was curious about
the
dash
that.
Ones and the dash threes.
I submitted the dash ones, and then I don't really want to consider those at this point in time. I would only want to be considering the dash three amendments.
But
they are both before you.
Thank you.
Right. Other questions?
And the dash three just basically close up the problems that have resulted from the definition of a smoke shop. And I think you'll have the department here to talk to you about that.
All right. Any other questions for the senator? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Good luck. We're almost done.
All right. All right. So what I'm going to do, I have, it looks like, 3 people that have signed up for giving testimony on Senate Bill 974. I'm going to go ahead and ask all of you to come up at this time, and that is Dr. Melvin Fraun. Is it Rita Taha and Shade Mazin, I believe. I apologize if I've butchered anyone's names. I'm trying to read them off the list we have here. And, Doctor, I'm going to let you go first. And I need you to, you have written testimony today. I need you to summarize instead of reading your testimony into the record.
Absolutely. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the acting director of the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to support not only this bill in its original form, but also the Dash 3 amendments to which Senator Mona Sanderson referred in her testimony. From my perspective, the issue here really is that when the smoke shop exemption was included in the smoke-free workplace law, the legislature had a very specific intent. And that intent was to allow customers to try new products before they made a decision about purchasing. The way that the law is written, however, has allowed a proliferation of other kinds of establishments, and the screenshots that I've handed out to you have some examples of this that, frankly, go way, way beyond that. And so this bill, with its amendments, are an attempt to fix that. The use of these products is dangerous, we believe. It is something that encourages smoking and does not discourage tobacco use. And I would be happy to speak, if members have questions, to some of the specific health issues that are of concern to us as well. But really the focus here is you had a specific purpose in mind when you passed that bill, and I don't believe that these establishments fit into what was intended. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Gentlemen, whoever wants to give your testimony, what I need you to do is please tell us your name for the record, and then proceed. And what I'd like for you to do, I know you didn't hand in written testimony. I need to limit the testimony about 2 to 3 minutes because I have 2 or 3 other public hearings I need to conduct today. Okay? Thank you. And thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you for having us here. Mr. Chairman, I would like to bring my name is Riyad Taha. I am representing a few of the hookah lounge owners that are present over here today. I would like to bring to light, that Bill 974 is very unwarranted, although the intentions and concerns are very genuine, but it is rather a hypocrisy in a way. To protect the people, if we are concerned about the health, First, I mean, there's a lot. We should ban McDonald's. That is very bad for your health. We should ban margarine. We should ban Top Ramen. That kills you down the road. We can compare hookah and cigarettes. Cigarettes have over 600 additives in them. Hookah has glycerine, tobacco, and sugar flavoring. And it is a very far, you know, comparison from the 600 additives that, when burned, they process a very toxic, you know, not one, but many toxic chemicals that are, you know, deadly for you. The tobacco in the hookah is heated rather than burnt. So the coals sit on top of the head that is separated with an aluminum foil. The tobacco gets heated, it doesn't get burnt. So you're not smoking the actual, all the burnt material that's coming off of it. And if we're really concerned about the public health, hookah is, you know, by decision. People smoke it, they can stop it after a while if they like. We should go after guns. Those are killing people. Alcohol, that's killing way many more people. But, you know, the atmosphere in the hookah lounges is very friendly, is very family-like. People feel welcome, like they're in one big family. And when they go there, all these kids from 18 to 21 mostly, hookah lounges, it keeps them in a safe environment. It gives them a home to go to rather than engaging in very unsafe and illegal activities. It brings back the social life to people rather than playing video games all the time. It creates, it revives the nature of the whole human being. Senate Bill 571 was intended towards the labor law. It wasn't intended towards health care issues as far as protecting the employees. Hookah lounges, whoever work at a hookah, they're mostly owner-operated. But if there is an employee working there, that employee, one of the requirements is for the employee to be proficient at making a hookah, fixing it, preparing it, serving it, doing all these things. So whoever works there smokes the hookah regularly as a user. So we're not endangering, we're not imposing smoking on anyone, such as, you know, some people at, such waitresses or waiters. They are obligated to work at a bar and being exposed to smoke because there's no other opportunities. But at hookah lounges, the requirement for the employees to smoke it and know what it is. So there is no extra danger that we're adding to it or exposing them to. And last but not least, the point, the very major point I'd like to bring up, if a person that is over 18 is old enough to go to war, don't they have the right to make the decision if they want to smoke or not, if they want to go to a certain establishment or not? And I will end my testimony at that.
All right, thank you.
And excuse my improper articles of closing, as I did not think I was going to testify.
No, no, you're fine. We're welcome that you're here. Thank you for sharing your story with us. And if you'd like to put something on the record.
My name is Shadi Yassin, and I am the owner of Nara Hookah Lounge in Gresham. I kind of feel bad because all this came out because of my place opening up in Gresham. Being in Gresham, I got targeted by people, the newspaper, and whatnot. People in Gresham were not enlightened about hookah lounges. They were very confused about what goes on in there and whatnot. And that's what brought everything up about changing the law. The senator gave a statement about each bowl of hookah is equivalent to 200 cigarettes, I believe. And I don't think that's very accurate because I did some research on the internet and found otherwise. And I could photocopy this and provide you guys with it. Two, I paid the taxes. I paid the high traffic impact fees in Gresham. Provided a nice place, a nice area for young teenagers to be at. And now we're everybody's wanting to shut us down. when I agree with him when he said, at 18, you can go to war. At 18, you can do many things. Why shut down a hookah business that you choose to go to at 18 when you know that it can cause you harm? Tanning salons cause you harm, and people are allowed to go tanning at the age of 14. That's never been addressed. People can go into GNC and buy pro-hormones, and they can get side effects that are bad for your health, hair loss, and many other things. Coffee can be consumed by 14, 13, 15, 16, 10-year-olds. And caffeine is very, very bad for your health. That's never been brought up. There's a lot of bad things that it does for you. I'm just going to keep it simple and finish up by saying there's absolutely nothing wrong with providing a safe environment in an area, which is Rockwood, that's in need. Hookah lounges are accepted, socially accepted everywhere. They've been accepted in Beaverton, Clackamas, down in Corvallis. Nobody's ever made a complaint before until we opened up in Gresham. Is Gresham too nice of a place for a hookah lounge? I don't know. I mean, you guys, I'm pretty sure people are very aware of Rockwood area and how not good it is. And for somebody like me to take a risk and open a business to provide a safe environment for young youth to be able to come in and do homework, use free internet, watch TV, listen to music, and hang out is bad. And I honestly don't know what we can provide for Rockwood to have it get up and have trendy people come in there.
All right, thank you. Questions for Senator Boquist?
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. I got two quick questions, real simple. First question is for the two younger gentlemen. Do you serve tea?
We do.
Second question is for the doctor, Mr. Chair. Are you familiar with the Islamic culture?
Chair Przanski, Senator Boquist, yes.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So then you understand where this fits in the middle of the Islamic culture and the impact of this type of bill?
Chair Przanski, Senator Boquist, I think I do, and I guess I would say that this is not a bill that outlaws hookahs altogether. We're talking about a very specific provision that was crafted in the smoke-free workplace law around smoke shops, and what's happening in there is not, these are not smoke shops as you all intended them to be.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yes. For the record, I voted for the bill. I know what I voted for. Thank you, Doctor.
All right.
Yes. Yes, I just have a simple question. I wanted to give it to the young gentleman. To your knowledge, has anyone ever accidentally entered your establishment and accidentally participated in the smoking, or do they do it voluntarily?
Nobody accidentally does it.
Thank you.
All right. Last comment.
They do make nicotine-free flavored tobacco. Just to note that on the record.
All right. Thank you very, very much for being here today. I'm going to ask y'all to step back. I do have one other person just want to put something on the record. Phil, why don't you come forward for the, I think this, you're here for the American Heart Association. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 974? All right, Phil, very quickly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the American Heart Association here to speak in support of Senate Bill 974. As chief proponents of the Clean Indoor Air Act, we certainly didn't expect this loophole to occur under the smoke shop definition. In fact, Mr. Chair, you may specifically recall the work that we did to narrow this exemption to areas or locations where the sale of tobaccos and not necessarily lounges, as we debated whether there should be alcohol allowed in those establishments. And so just wanted to get on the record our hope that this bill gets acted upon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. You're free. All right. What I'm going to do is go ahead and close the public hearing now on 974, and then councils direct me as to where we want to go next.
If you want to go back to your public hearing.
All right. All right. We're going to go back to reopen 846, and at this point, I've got looks like Megan Colley, Bob Jundoff, and Gail Myers. Kind of limit your testimony as best you can. Realize this is a very broad subject, and I expect we'll be coming back to it.
Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I will just bottom line it and say we're very happy to have this bill, and we want to thank Senator Bates and his staff for presenting it. This has been a dilemma for the defense counsel for a very long time, how to represent those clients of ours who have mental illness, whether they should proceed with a GEI or not. We just simply want to say we support the bill. We understand there will be further discussions. We're happy to be at the table. And also on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union, they also would request an opportunity to weigh in because they also are very concerned for the civil liberties aspect of the situation.
Thank you. Megan?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahay. I'm Vice President of Mental Health America of Oregon, and I'm pleased to be able to support this bill. I want to say that people with mental illness are often used to having discrimination and prejudice, and I think this bill is about fairness. Oftentimes, some of the PSRB things can violate the basic rights of people with mental illness, and this bill helps set right some of the problems with the PSRB. Stigma does not contribute to people gaining recovery, and I think that justice inspires recovery, and fair treatment is the friend of recovery. Senator Bates talked about integrated care, and I just want to point out that people with mental health, serious mental health issues, die at a rate of 25 to 38 years earlier than the general population, and it's very important that we get a handle on integrated mental health and physical health. And I just also want to point out that Senator Bates was talking about being able to move people through the system out of the Oregon State Hospital into placements within the community and shift the hospital costs, that money that we're spending on hospital, to community services. And I think that's a great idea. Also, Oregon needs to move people out of the Oregon State Hospital in order to be in compliance with the Olmstead Act, and this bill would help with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundoff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Our organization has outreach workers at the hospital, state hospital, every week. And we have been doing this since 1986. We're very familiar with that environment and with the systems that flow in and out of the hospital. I want to thank Senator Bates for bringing this matter forward. I think it is absolutely essential. The state hospital is the most expensive piece of mental health services that we provide. It's a very precious resource, and it's a valuable one, and it's very important that we look at how we're using it and use it efficiently and effectively, both in terms of providing good mental health services for the people who are there, supporting our community mental health system, and keeping the public safe. These are all factors that are very important. Right now, in my estimation, we're not doing this effectively and efficiently. It's because we've got a system that was set up a long time ago under different conditions. And again, I think Senator Bates is quite right. We looked at it and get all the parties to the table and figure out what's going to work.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you very much for coming forward today. I've got three other people that would like to give testimony, Lynn Ray, Mary Claire Buckley, and Kevin. I understand you wanted to come up and put something on the records. If you do, why don't you come on up?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Len Ray, and I am the administrator for adult mental health services with addictions and mental health at DHS. We appreciate Senator Bates bringing this bill forward. AMH does support the concept of this bill, and we believe there are a number of complicated issues, however, between the linkage of the criminal justice system and the mental health system. AMH would recommend language that would require an addictions and mental health assessment as early as possible in the arrest and booking process to determine if people could benefit from either drug courts or mental health courts as a way of diverting people from Oregon State Hospital. AMH would also recommend that assessments be completed by practitioners who have been trained in conjunction with the PSRB and certified by addictions and mental health. AMH also believes that the Oregon State Hospital is really one treatment modality in an array of services for people with mental health disorders, and that the State Hospital should not be seen as a destination for anyone, but rather a treatment site. We believe that people who can be safely treated in the community need to be diverted from OSH, and we also believe that by treating low-level offenders with high-risk offenders, we're using scarce public resources that really could be used better in the community. There needs to also be a balance between the community safety and the need for an individual's mental health treatment. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you.
Mr. Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. As some of you are aware, the board and its clients have been the subject of much interest, if not scrutiny, in the past 12 to 18 months. As a result, the board has welcomed and actively participated in concerted efforts, such as the governor's work group on siting, to improve this system. The board sees Senate Bill 846 as another such effort to address serious issues that face the state and its forensic system. The board has some concerns about 846 as written, but is supportive of the notion of an interim work group to explore these concepts in a deliberate and comprehensive way with the goal of bringing legislation forward in the next session. The board is very aware that the state hospital is a scarce and expensive resource. It is not the board's intent to use that resource for individuals who do not need that level of care, but we want to be mindful that community resources need to be available for these individuals if we are going to change the system. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I think Ms. Buckley very well articulated in large part the position of the district attorneys. Obviously, we appreciate Senator Bates introducing this topic to this committee. The piece that I'd like to bring forward is these issues not only affect, obviously, those individuals who suffer from mental illness. There's a very important public safety component in here, and we hope as the committee chooses to move forward, if indeed a work group is created, we want to be sure that public safety is represented on that work group and has an opportunity to weigh in on these absolutely critical issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. For Mr. Ray, you state that AMH would also recommend language that assessment be completed by practitioners who are trained in partnership with PSRB and certified by AMH. Would it not be more appropriate to have these practitioners certified by the licensing board that certifies the practitioners than by DHS?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, I'm not sure if it would be more appropriate. The thought behind having a certification process within AMH was so that there would be one entity that could review all of the practitioners regardless of their licensure board to assure that their training and their assessments would be in keeping with what the intent of those assessments need to be. Excuse me.
Is it correct that the practitioners that work for Department of Human Services in this category would not necessarily have to be licensed?
No, the practitioners would need to be licensed to complete assessments.
Would these practitioners be include like psychologists who the DHS normally hires that are not licensed and in fact are exempt from licensing?
These practitioners would not be employees of DHS, but they would be a separate group of practitioners who could be contracted with to provide the assessments so that they would be independent of the DHS's purview, if you will, but would be certified under one set of certification rules.
She's in the back.
Yes.
Department of Human Services routinely contracts with psychologists who are not licensed in Oregon.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for coming forward. I don't believe there's anyone else, but I will go ahead and ask if there was anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 846. Not seeing anyone coming forward, we're closing the public hearing on 846. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 877.
The people that do psychological examination on parental.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 877 changes attorney fee awards and removal fill cases from prevailing party to prevailing plaintiff. It applies to actions after the effective date. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have two people that are signed up, Dave Moskowitz and is it Thane Tinson?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is David Moskowitz, and here today on behalf of a number of conservation organizations that seek to return the only environmental law, citizen supervision in Oregon, that has allowed citizens to enforce the state's laws on the fill and removal program protecting wetlands in Oregon. And this citizen enforcement of environmental laws has a long history in the United States, and as a first-year law student, I participated in a case that was a Federal Clean Water Act case in Washington County against the water treatment facilities in Washington County, and in that case, it really turned an agency completely around there, where there were multiple violations, thousands of violations, and it's made that agency into a countywide, Tualatin Basin-wide entity that's protecting clean water, and that it protects both developers and it protects citizens, and it protects the ecology of that basin, and it's a very proactive entity, and that was really started by that case. So with me today is Thane Tinson, who is a practicing attorney in Oregon with experience in a number of these cases, and I'd just like to have him talk to you briefly about this bill. And we appreciate the opportunity to bring this to the committee. We know you have a very full schedule, but thank you, and I'll turn it over.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Thane Tinson, 1300 Southwest 5th Avenue,
Portland, Oregon. I actually was counsel for the Northwest Environmental Defense Center in the lawsuit that Dave Moskowitz has referenced. And for those of you who are familiar with our federal environmental laws, you know that citizen suit provisions have been an enormous boon to the enforcement of our environmental laws at the federal level. I dare say that the history of the enforcement of those laws would be a vastly different one without the beneficial provision of and prosecution of these citizen suits. But in this particular provision, which has been on the books in Oregon since the same time that those federal environmental laws were passed, 1973, has been almost never used at a citizen suit provision. And the reason is that it provides for attorney's fees to the prevailing party, not the prevailing plaintiff. And that is a big difference. Because even in the face of a clear or what appears to be a clear violation of the wetland laws, an illegal fill, an illegal removal, there's always risk associated with bringing a citizen enforcement provision. And just as by way of background, you should know, just as in the federal scheme, here the only way in which a citizen suit provision would be brought in any event would be upon 60 days advance notice to the agency, give the agency the opportunity to investigate and decide whether to bring its own enforcement action or administrative proceeding. And only if it does not is there an allowance for a citizen suit to go forward. But again, this law isn't used here because of this prevailing party provision. And I know from personal experience the chilling effect that it can have. I was a couple of years ago, I had a client come forward to me, said, I've got an illegal fill in the creek next to my property, and this was something that we went to the agency on. They were a little concerned. It was an intermittent creek. It wasn't clear that it was truly a water of the state. As you may know, there's a lot of controversy about what and what does not constitute waters of the United States, waters of the state. But it was clear that this was done without a permit, clear who the benefited party was, not clear, however, who actually did the illegal fill, and that can present a problem and risk to a would-be plaintiff. The same thing is true with whether or not you brought it within 60 days or not. That could be an issue. There could be a problem about whether, in fact, as I've just mentioned, it truly constitutes the waters of the state. There are pleadings problems, potentially, service issues, filing issues. All of these things add up to risk for a would-be plaintiff, and all of them collectively act as a significant deterrent rather than incentive to supplement agency enforcement efforts, because you're looking at a bill that could easily amount to, well, certainly going to amount to thousands and perhaps tens of thousands of dollars if the prevailing party wins. And I was, in my written remarks there, I point out a situation I just had a couple of months ago.
Yeah, saying I'm going to need you to wrap up because I've got another two hearings.
Simply changing this prevailing plaintiff provision rather than prevailing party, you've done an enormous boon supplementing an already strapped and underfunded agency enforcement effort, and I don't believe there's any opposition from DSL itself. There's two other small changes in this, but they're important as well, and they would include permit violations in the category of violations that could be pursued via citizen efforts, again, if the agency chooses not to do so. But I do urge this committee to pass this board.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Wissett.
Senator Brzezinski, thank you. We have an equal risk and equal chilling deterrent for attempting to defend against an unwarranted third-party suit. And I find your risk of the plaintiff as being somewhat absurd. I'm sorry. The current level playing field appropriately deters that frivolous lawsuit.
Well,
and I just don't see the point in making it creates open season on people who want to mine aggregate, who want to do all sorts of things. I just can't support this.
Okay.
Is there a question, sir?
No, that was just a comment.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Can I ask a quick question, Mr. Chair?
I think Senator Dingfelder wanted to ask a question.
I was going to wait for the other, but it's fine.
Okay. Well, we've already had both of them testify.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that he would, that the center would said it finished.
I think that was just
okay.
That, that
yeah. So I guess I, what would be helpful for clarifications, you referenced the federal laws as far as, can you clarify, are most of the federal statutes, do they allow for citizen suits? I'm very familiar with Clean Water Act, but other federal statutes, is it usually the prevailing party or prevailing plaintiff?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, yes. Under federal law, it is a prevailing plaintiff that is awarded attorney's fees, but not a prevailing party. You always pay costs if you lose a lawsuit. That, and the same would be true here. And you're always giving the agency first bite at the apple, even under federal law. But here, unlike federal law, it's a prevailing party. And I mean, the proof is in the pudding. We have not had citizen enforcement. This bill has been on the books 36 years. It's virtually never been taken advantage of by a citizen. And the reason is because of this pervading party language.
All right. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thane, you mentioned the federal law. What about other states that have similar provisions at this
point? Well, I'm familiar with Washington's laws, and they provide for prevention. Because I practice in Washington, I'm also familiar with Alaska because we have Alaska office there. And there are strong provisions in Washington state law for citizen suits. And, in fact, Washington, as you may know, also has a state NEPA provision as well in which citizens can take advantage of this. So this would be essentially mirroring what other states have already done. California also has state citizen suit provisions that are taken advantage of by environmental groups and interested and concerned citizens there.
And just to clarify, those have prevailing plaintiff provisions?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, yes, that's correct.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Was there anyone else who want to give testimony on 877? Not seeing anyone, I'll close the public hearing on 877. What we're going to do now is take a short break before we go into our next public hearing. I want to make certain that I take care of work sessions that we're ready to go forward on. And, Council, I'm going to go ahead and open one up on Senate Bill 126.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 126 has the -2 amendment. This is the bill that requires motor carriers to report to the Oregon Department of Transportation within 10 days if an employee refuses a drug test, specifies hearings procedures, and it has the new amendment is the -2 amendment, and it removes Section 7, which talked about the civil liability and exempted ODOT and the motor carrier from civil liability. We removed that the provision out of the bill, and it also rewrites the line 6 from page 2, line 6, in response to the ACLU's comments at the hearings. Just going forward, that was a kind of a Scrivener's error, if you remember. This bill has a fiscal statement issued. I don't have the fiscal statement in front of me, but you do. And so I think the committee would like to recommend a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this one.
Yes, I've spoken to the department. They would like the bill to go forward with the -2s. They also understand and accept that this needs to be referred or recommended to be referred to Ways and Means. And so that, with that, the chair is willing to take a motion on the -2s.
Move the -2s, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves the -2s into Senate Bill 126. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 126 with the -2s.
To Ways and Means.
Excuse me?
Isn't it to Ways and Means?
Will be.
Right. Okay. Right, with a due pass to Ways and Means. Then I'll speak my motion, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 126 as amended by the -2s with a due pass recommendation. I'm going to say to Ways and Means, or to the floor, but with a recommendation to the President for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Okay.
Just to my motion, Mr. Chair. This is an issue we actually do need to resolve, so it's higher on my priority list. It does need to go down to Ways and Means due to the, I'm surprised at the dollar figure here, which needs to be resolved, but I'll be supporting it, Mr. Chair.
My understanding, though, this is other funds. I don't think there's going to be a real issue here from what, at least from the department's perspective, that this just needs to really go through and get the authorization to actually appropriate and use the funds.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I concur with you. I'm philosophically, if it's got money, it's got to go to Ways and Means.
Right.
Got gotcha. Nothing to do with the department. If it's got money, it needs to be approved by the Ways and Means.
And I agree with you. All right. Anything else? All right. Any objection? So ordered. And no
travel carrier would be necessary on that bill. And then we're going to go ahead and close the work session on the Senate Bill 126 and open up a work session on 687.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 687, we heard on April 7th this transfer of abandoned property from a lawyer trust account for benefit of the legal services program. We have a Dash 3 amendment, and that amendment basically was to reduce the fiscal, I believe it, transfers amount directly from a lawyer trust account directly to the state bar without involving the Department of State Lands. Abandoned property in the lawyer trust accounts will be reported to DSL, indicating it is a lawyer trust account, and any claims on the property will be forwarded to the Oregon State Bar. This requires rulemaking by DSL and Oregon State Bar, and there's a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 3s into the main bill.
Senator Broquist moves the Dash 3s into Senate Bill 687. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I guess we'll move to the floor. Right.
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Chair, move SB 687 with the Dash 3s to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Broquist now moves Senate Bill 687 as amended by the Dash 3s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Question, Council.
Yes.
In your opinion, does this remove the precedent-setting situation where the lost and found materials are kept in perpetuity by the Department of State Lands? Is Department of State Lands okay with that, and are you okay with that? Is that this does not set a precedent for releasing those funds for the corpus of the funds for use rather than returning them to the rightful owner should the rightful owner arrive?
Sorry, Senator Witt said I don't feel comfortable giving my opinion about a question like that. DSL does keep in perpetuity in this situation. A claimant can go to the Oregon State Bar and get the money back.
Right. My understanding from the testimony is that if someone came in after the funds had been transferred to the State Bar making a claim, that would be referred to the State Bar to be paid out. And the record reflects, correct me if I'm wrong, that everyone agreed that that's how it would work, and it would just basically be shifted for payment, and that they understand they would have to pay that obligation out of the funds that they had in there and at the State Bar, similar to other entities that have had these same arrangements. So, yeah, my understanding is everything stays the same. We're just setting up another means for use of the money instead of letting it just sit there without having other use. All right. Any other questions? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see. Senator Bonamici, would you like to carry this one?
I would very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. And we'll close the work session on 687. Now, regarding, we have two other bills that are set for work session today, and that is Senate Bill 284. I'm opening it up for the purpose of carrying that bill over till Monday, closing that work session. I'm opening one on 971, carrying that over till this Monday, which is the 27th of April, and closing that one. All right, so that takes care of our work sessions. And that will take us back to our last bill, which is more of a continuation of some testimony. And this is Senate Bill 295. I'm opening a public hearing on 295 and 809, understanding that let's just open them up.
Chair, members of the committee, you have Senate Bill 809 before you and 295, and you may want to consider them both at the same time. We had a hearing on 809 on March 30th. This bill comes to you from the Judiciary Committee, and 295 comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Defense Attorneys Association. You may remember at that time we had a lengthy discussion concerning DA charging practices of the state of Washington, the comparison between the state of Washington. You may have seen the article in the Oregonian on Sunday, once again comparing Washington to Oregon. In 295, we have before us, there are actually five amendments, but you have four of us before you. The fifth is still a work in progress. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look at the amendments and you look at 295, what you have here, and I'll go through the several amendments that impact 295, is the Washington statute. But you may remember that in Washington, there are five cases at the trial level in the death penalty area, and in Oregon, somewhere 51, 52, 53. And what you have on the dash if you want to look at the dash 4 amendments or dash 1 amendments, and let me see, the dash 2 amendments, 1, 2, and 4 at the same time. One comes from the criminal defense bar, and if I best bet would be to probably look at it and read the language. The court may not sentence the defendant to death under the statute unless the district attorney files and serves notice of intent to seek a sentence of death in accordance with the section. Except for good cause shown, the notice must be filed with the court and served in the counsel of the defendant no later. And the dash 4 amendments change 30 to 180 days. So it says no later than 180 days after the defendant charged with aggravated murder is held to answer the following preliminary hearing is arraigned on an indictment, a ways indictment. And then in no event may the court allow a district attorney to file and serve notice less than 90 days before trial. The section 2, the provision that would have prevented the district attorney from putting evidence in later, the court may not omit evidence at sentence hearing unless the evidence is described. That's been removed. So that would liberalize the bill up, for lack of a better term. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is in the dash 1 amendments. And then we have before us the dash 2 amendments, which is basically the second half of the Washington statute. And that is basically after the trial and the death penalty has been imposed. The Supreme Court shall approve, but is not limited to the following. Whether there is sufficient evidence to justify the imposition of the sentence of death, considering the nature of the crime and the characteristics of the defendant, whether the sentence of death is exclusive or disproportionate to the sentence imposed in similar cases, whether the sentence of death was brought about through prejudice, and whether the defendant is mentally retarded.
All right.
So that's the review the Washington Supreme Court goes through after the death penalty has been imposed. So were these amendments modified for Oregon, what you would have in 295 would be the Washington model, Chair Members of the Committee. And then we have the dash 3 amendments. I think you heard testimony about the number of cases are in post-conviction relief. The Oregonian mentions the fact that one of these cases is going back to trial level for the fourth time. And what this would do is it would have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court appoint a panel of retired judges experienced in the death penalty who would review the case for the purposes of making recommendations concerning a settlement offer of life without the possibility of parole, probably, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I assume they could also include that, the waiver of right of appeal.
All right. Thank you. What I'm going to do, we have two panels of three. I'm going to go ahead and bring up Josh Marquis, Ben Unger, and Doug Harford first. And just to let everyone know, we're about 17 minutes till the hour. I'm going to lose at least one member at 10. And what I'm going to do is go to 10:05. So that means I'm going to give each side, each panel, about 10 minutes. Okay, and we can maybe stay longer than that. So we'll have a little flexibility just to see how everything comes in. All right, so I'm sorry, I thought Ben was coming up. I misread the things. Ronell, thank you for being here.
Chair Prozonsky, Ben had to leave. My apologies.
And gentlemen, ladies, whoever.
Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, my name's Doug Harkelroad. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I took office in January of 1985. The state of Oregon got the death penalty back again. I think we've had it six times in December of 1984. So virtually that entire time that we've had it, I was the district attorney. There are five people. There are five people on death row because I decided we should try to kill them. Now, I say it that way on purpose because seeking the death penalty is way too out there. What we're actually trying to do is we're doing state-sponsored killing. And there are only 36 people in this state that get to choose. Ultimately, it's each of those district attorneys in that jurisdiction at that time. And I'm very happy that we have a statute that allows us to carefully choose. These are very, very serious decisions, and I've spent many, many hours thinking about what should happen to individuals. And so I have chosen a number of times to try to kill somebody. That's a very serious event. But what I really want you to understand is how this statute works and how the DAs use it. And those of us in larger jurisdictions obviously made those decisions more times than the smaller jurisdictions. So here's what happens. Somebody kills somebody in the community. The practice of many DAs is to personally go to that incident while that investigation is on. I always thought I was better if I went there. So I went to most of the murder situations in Lane County for 24 years. All right, Joe, you go there. You learn something. You make some decisions. You help the police. Okay, now there's a charging decision. There are, I believe, and I haven't counted these, but I believe there's 33 ways to charge aggravated murder in the state of Oregon. Okay, you got to have an aggravated murder or you don't get to the death penalty. And so you make those decisions very carefully about charging. And you take those to the grand jury, and you present those to the grand jury, and seven individuals decide whether or not that aggravated murder should be charged. It's not just the DA. And their standard is a pretty high standard of proof. So, now you've got that charged. Then there is this question about, should we seek death or true life or 30-year life? Those are the three options for a jury. And that's a really serious decision. And I don't like to rush it. And I don't think most DAs like to rush it. And so the way that analysis goes is we need to know from when that individual who's charged, from their birth, what their life was all about. What's the mitigation in here? What's the aggravation in here? We need to learn about them. We send police officers around this country, at least in our jurisdiction, if the individual's not from Lane County, to find out about them. And if there's a military component in there, or there's a mental health component, we work really hard to get all of that information so that we can then put it against this statute that's a combination of the voters and a combination of prior legislatures, and look at the four questions that must be answered unanimously by 12 jurors, 48 yes answers, before the judge can impose death. And so, briefly, one is it deliberate? Two is the guy gal going to be dangerous in the future? Is there a probability of that? I'm colloquializing these a little, but it moves it much faster. Was there any provocation by the person who's dead or not? And then lastly, and I was here when this statute was modified because of a Supreme Court of the United States decision, whether the defendant should receive a death sentence. That's very broad. The jury gets to consider that. So that's all the mitigation evidence, and that's all the aggravation evidence. And so rushing to decide that is wrong. Rushing to decide that is wrong. And so that's how we make the decision. And I'd suggest those are made very carefully by prosecutors around the country. I don't think you see cases where there is sloppy decision making by the elected official. By the way, I like very much that it's elected official that has to make these decisions. They're responsible to the people, just as you folks are. Okay, so if you're going to change this statute, which I think works pretty well, you have to ask yourselves, why? Why would I change this statute? Okay. Certainly money is an issue this time. These are also the most important and serious cases that are done in the state of Oregon. So be very careful. Be very careful if you're going to try to save a few bucks or a few million bucks in a spot. But ask yourselves why. And with that, I'll stop.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Josh Marquis. I'm the district attorney in Clatsop County, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I also am probably the only person in this room who has been both lead counsel on behalf of a defendant in capital cases. In fact, I was up against Doug's office for almost 2 years in 1989 and 1990. I represented three people who were facing capital murder.
But most of my career of the last 19 years has been spent as both Chief Deputy DA in Deschutes County and for the last 15 as the District Attorney in Clatsop County. And I say that because the death penalty in Oregon is very different than the death penalty in other states. I would challenge anyone to look at the 35, 36 people on Oregon's death row and really say there is anyone that doesn't belong there. And you may very well be able to do that in other states. Oklahoma, for example, a state with our population, has about almost three times the number of people on death row. But the death penalty is a decision that is made state by state, and more importantly that, county by county, and more importantly that, case by case. I want to give you a real practical example. In 1997, two young men named Jesse McAllister and Bradley Price went on the beach in Seaside in a nice summer day and wanted to see what it felt like to just kill two people. So they arbitrarily picked Brooke Goza, a local artist, and Casey Nims, a fisherman, who were just down there to watch the sunrise, shot him in the head for absolutely no reason, and fled to Mexico. It was referred to by the press as a thrill killing. They were at large in Mexico for over a year. But Jesse McAllister, who had a fairly extensive criminal record, came back across the Matamoros-Brownsville border and was apprehended. And because he came back into the United States voluntarily, he was extradited from Texas and was definitely facing the death penalty, both because of the brutality of the murder and because of his own criminal record. His attorney, I didn't even really have a chance, although I'd been working on the case for almost a year, to really examine whether we were going to seek the death penalty. Within, I think, no more than 4 or 5 weeks, his attorney came to me and said, if you do not seek the death penalty, we will plead. There will be no appeals. There will be no need for the victims to go through it. I thought about it for a relatively short period of time and said, okay. Mr. Price, on the other hand, was apprehended in Mexico, and I was advised by the U.S. Department of State that I had 3 hours to sign a document in which I had to agree that not only would I not seek the death penalty, but presumably prosecutors in Mexico must have more authority, I had the guarantee that I would not permit the execution of Mr. Price, something I think is a little bit beyond the power of a prosecutor. But in any event, I had to guarantee that he would not, and we are bound by these treaties. You can't just sign it and say, I'm not going to do it. Mr. Price came back, therefore he was not facing the death penalty. He went to trial. We had a lengthy trial. We had a lengthy penalty hearing. I am sure hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent on the defense. The article in the Oregonian, I think, highlighted a case, in fact, that I personally have spent the last 17 years of my life involved in, the Randy Guzik case. And I think you heard testimony about that. I don't want to repeat that.
But Josh, I just need to get you to wrap up, Mr. Cutrunnell. And we're already on 12, 13 minutes on this one, and I'm trying to say equal time for both sides.
I'll get one or two points, if I may, Chair Przanski. The article in the Oregonian made the point that about $2 million was spent on defending Mr. Guzik, and probably $100,000. The costs are in the defense. I would not want to live in a state where we decide we are going to short justice. I'm very proud when I speak around the country about capital punishment that in Oregon we provide adequate counsel. Very, very briefly, I would just ask you to look carefully at the -2, -3, -4, -5 amendments. They are not going to save money. They are going to interpose other further barriers that are going to cost a lot of money. -2 is going to basically ask the Supreme Court to do de novo review. That means they're going to have to literally read the entire transcript. They're going to be making other decisions. The -3 amendments create a panel, which I'll tell you as a practical matter already happens. We have settlement judges that come forward. -5, which I know you don't have in front of you, I frankly find incredibly offensive. It basically says if you want to seek the death penalty, your county has to pony up the money. And I think that Representative AOC is sitting in the back of the room. We got to pass that. And I don't think we want a situation where rich counties people get the death penalty and poor counties people don't. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice here today on behalf of Attorney General John Kroger. My apologies, he is out of town, wasn't able to be here, as is our Deputy Attorney General Mary Williams. However, she's happy to come back and provide more information. Our part of this process really, in addition to partnering with the district attorneys, is the appellate end of this process and the defense of the criminal convictions. Doug and Josh both spoke very eloquently to how thorough how the process currently is in Oregon and why it works, and we would agree with that. Our part of the process is also very thorough and therefore does take a long amount of time, but necessarily so. We believe the process works as it currently exists. We also agree that the amendments are likely to increase processing time for us and therefore not save costs. And so we are here today to share those concerns with you, and I will just leave it at that due to the amount of time.
Great. Thank you. Questions?
Just very fair. I'd like to ask the three of them to talk with me offline. I'd like to discuss the military component that was raised here. Since I'm one of the evil criminal veterans that Homeland Security says ought to be watched.
All right. All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our last panel for today includes Matt Rubenstein, Rich Wolf, and Kathy Berger. And just to give you, you know, equal time, we have about 12 minutes.
Members of the committee, I wanted to follow up on some remarks Mr. Harkelrode made regarding.
Can you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm Matthew Rubenstein. I'm with the Oregon Capital Resource Center. I litigate capital cases. I'm funded by the Public Defense Services Commission to facilitate and coordinate high-quality representation in death penalty cases. I testified last month. Thank you for inviting me back.
In Oregon, we have between 51 and 54 cases pending. In the fall, we had 54 cases. That's dropped a bit. In the Tri-County area, in Multnomah County, we had 21 cases pending. Clackamas County, 9 cases pending. In Washington County, we had 2 cases pending. So 32 of the 54 cases were pending in the Tri-County area. Mr. Harkelrode described a process where there's a lot of deliberation and thought going into selecting these cases. I respectfully would suggest that's not representative of the practice across the state. Bob Herman, the district attorney from Washington County, testified to your committee several weeks ago. It's his assertion that he does not exercise discretion. A murder case occurs, his detectives investigate the case, the facts are presented to a grand jury. If the facts are sufficient to charge aggravated murder, an aggravated murder indictment is brought. Norm Frink, who's the deputy district attorney in charge of capital litigation, death penalty litigation in Multnomah County, publicly asserts that he seeks or files aggravated murder charges in virtually every homicide case that he can, because he sees it as a tool to encourage guilty pleas. That's why in the Tri-County area we have over 30 cases pending, when Washington State has between usually 3 and 5 cases pending. There's a tremendous cost in filing so many cases, and the litigation, as we all know, is complex and quite expensive. The Amendment -5 would set up a process in which the counties would see the cost. At this time, Multnomah County can have 20 cases pending. It can cost the state of Oregon tens of millions of dollars, but Norm Frink, the prosecutor, the county commissioners don't see that cost in any way. In Washington State, where they have 5 cases pending, which is a high mark there, one of the reasons they have so many they have many fewer cases, they're more selective on the front end. The prosecutors, there's more deliberation going on the front end. Who are we going to select as the worst of the worst, and what resources are we going to target as prosecution and defense to seek a death sentence? It's irrational and wasteful in Oregon when that process doesn't happen for a year or 2 years. Most of our cases settle. Again, we've had approximately 22 cases that went to a penalty phase where jurors decided life or death over a 5-year period from 2004 to 2008. So that's a relatively small number of cases that are actually going. The vast majority are pleading. But there's a tremendous cost in prosecuting and defending this enormous number of cases when it is not narrowed. The Amendment -5, you know, is a vehicle so that Multnomah County, if they wanted to prosecute 21 death penalty cases, they would be in a position to see those costs and have to come up with somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 million to process that many cases. Mr. Marquis alluded to the challenged anyone to come up with defendants on death row, men on, under sentence of death who shouldn't be there. And I think that was in response to Dash 3, an amendment which would create a review committee that would review these 34 men on death row, 35 if you count Mr. Guzik, to identify cases, many of which people in the criminal justice system believe, the older cases particularly, are vulnerable, and we shouldn't spend a lot of energy and money litigating these causes. Well, the Department of Justice is in the process of settling two of these cases. Two cases are now in the process, I believe, in the following month, will be settled. These men are going to accept life without parole pleas, go into general population. The state is going to save tremendous money from DOJ and on the defense side.
All right.
Be happy to address any questions.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Wolf. I'm an attorney. I've been licensed to practice law here in the state of Oregon for 22 years. I represent a number of people at the trial level charged with aggravated murder. I've argued capital murder cases before the Oregon Supreme Court, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and the Supreme Court of the United States. And I don't have any prepared written remarks, but I just want to briefly indicate that I think it may be helpful to the committee to just briefly understand the history, a brief history of the recent death penalty legislation. In 1979, we enacted our aggravated murder statute, and that required a judge to determine whether to impose death or not. In 1981, the Oregon Supreme Court held that that provision was unconstitutional and struck down the death penalty as only being judicially imposed. In 1981, the legislature met again, and because death was no longer an option for aggravated murder, the number of types of murders was greatly expanded in 1981 to what Mr. Hockerwald has indicated is at least 33 different ways which someone can be charged with aggravated murder. It was then in 1984 that the people by initiative added death again as a potential punishment for aggravated murder after we had greatly expanded the class of cases which are subject to an aggravated murder conviction, and then in 84, a death penalty. So what we have now is this enormous class of cases that can be subject to a death penalty, and as Mr. Rubenstein has indicated, the police investigate it. Many district attorneys believe if the facts are sufficient to charge it, it's charged. And then the costs begin immediately, because as a defense lawyer, I'm obligated under the American Bar Association guidelines, by Supreme Court mandate, and by ethical duty, to do a number of things which I would not be required to do in a non-capital case. I have to have a co-counsel. I have to have a member of the defense team that's expert in detecting mental illness. I have to hire numerous experts to evaluate my client and determine evaluate all kinds of things about my client's background. So the costs begin under the Oregon system immediately once a person is charged with aggravated murder, because death is always a potential penalty at that point. These amendments would defer the decision of whether or not this is truly a death case or not. And that, I believe, would be a good thing for a number of reasons. Fiscally, certainly, it would be a great benefit. And so I think that, as Mr. Harkelrode has said, this is a process that does take serious consideration. And as the system is presently designed, there is no mandate for there to be serious consideration or not of whether this is truly a death case. Is this an aggravated murder case that warrants life in prison? Or is it really the worst of the worst? And we don't, at this point, and with the way our legislation is set up now, we don't really determine that ultimate question until way at the end of the process. And often that's decided by a jury. My experience has also been there's a claim that without the death penalty, no one would plead guilty. In 2007, New Jersey abolished the death penalty. They have reported that they have had no depreciable change in the number of cases that are resolving by plea. In states that do not have the death penalty at all, have some of the highest percentages of people serving life without parole. And in fact, my experience has been that in many of these cases, my clients who are facing the death penalty say, well, yeah, if I got to do the rest of my life in prison, let's just go to trial because, you know, maybe death is better for me. And so, and that is not an unusual position for people to take. And the reality is that what it boils down to is many of these cases, it's not really a likelihood in many of these cases that a person will get death. And what you're arguing about in trying to settle these cases, is this going to be life with the possibility of parole or without the possibility of parole? And I think in those cases where the decision is removed, that death will be sought 6 months into the process, I don't believe it is going to appreciably affect the number of cases that settle.
All right, thank you. Kathy?
Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, I have nothing to add from Mr. Rubenstein or Mr. Wolf's comments given the time constraints, but I am available for questions.
All right, questions? Counsel?
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Rubenstein, in the state of Washington, who pays for the defense costs?
It's county-based. So the county is paying trial costs, trial expert fees at the trial stage.
And they pay for prosecution, too?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. No other questions. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 295, Paul, and 809? And then we've got some housekeeping stuff to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I've heard about the Dash 5 amendments today when I walked in the room. I'm just looking at them now for the first time, but they've also been described in testimony. We have an objection to the Dash 5 amendments, and the objection relates to a number of reasons. Primarily, I don't see how a county that is short on resources could ever impose the death penalty under the Dash 5 amendments. I think it creates inequities and situations that where uniformity of application of state laws would just not work, because there are counties in the state that would never pony up the money that it would take to meet the requirements of the Dash 5 amendments, if I understand correctly what they say. And I apologize, Mr. Chair, I'm just looking at them now. But that's the issue that we'd like to raise for you.
We'll talk
about this later.
All right. Any questions for Paul? Thank you for coming up, putting it on the record. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearings on 295 and 809. And what we're going to do is a couple things. First, everything that's on today's agenda that was not taken care of, and I'm going to go through those. Senate Bill 295, 809, Senate Bill 846, Senate Bill 877, Senate Bill 974, Senate Bill 284, and Senate Bill 971. Those are carrying over till Monday, and that's the 27th. The other two bills that we had on the agenda, which was SB 126 and SB 687, have been. Let's see. 126 went to Ways and Means, and
687 to the floor. I'm carrying it.
And which one?
687. We moved it to the floor.
I'm sorry. Yes, that's correct. 687 and 126 are the ones that we took care of. So they are on their way to their destinations. So the others are still on as carry-ons. The reason I'm doing this, we're down to the last 48 hours of having any actions on Senate bills. And instead of not preserving those until we have a chance to reflect on those, they are carrying over for that purpose. So the other part that we need to talk about is this next week. We have Monday and Tuesday. Tuesday at this point is just scheduled as a day for overflow. We do not have any bills at this point that are currently there. The intent of the chair is to leave that open like that. So there's a possibility that if we get everything done on
on Monday that we may not need to meet on Tuesday, but because of the fiscals paperwork coming in late, we've also reserved on Tuesday at 2:15 one of the hearing rooms, so we could potentially come back, because since we meet at 8 in the morning or 8:30 on Tuesday, some of the paperwork may not be ready for that afternoon. So I just want to let you know that we may need to have people come back, so we may be recessing on Tuesday. I may come in and just carry it over.
Senator. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the council will all be wearing track shoes on Tuesday, so we can run from one end of the building to the other.
Yeah, that's the other part, is because we got both committees that are going to be floating and trying to close out their respective bills. So realize that. And then the other thing...
Can I just, since three of us have a committee at 3, so hopefully we would recess at 3 if we needed to, correct?
The only reason that we will be coming back in the afternoon or even in the evening is because we've received a fiscal that we can come in and act on. And so that 2:15 is a time that we would hope to do that. If we think there's others coming, what we've already tried to organize, knowing that Environment and Natural Resources will be going from 3 to whenever, that we may need to have a break at some point to bring people back in to do something even after 5. So I just want to give everyone notice today. The other thing is, at this point, I am going to go ahead and have Fridays for the month of May set as to-be-announced schedules. And the reason for that is because we only have a month to be working House bills, and we'll have those open and reserved if we need to move bills into those slots. Of course, if there are new bills, they will have to be posted 48 hours beforehand. But just let you know that the Fridays at this point, they'll be at least posted for reservations if we need to accommodate that time. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? With that, we're adjourned, and we'll see everyone. Now, on Monday, I think we're scheduled for 8:30. This 8:45. Yeah, 8:45. We're going to adjourn to 8:45 because I think we got 8:30 on the schedule. Is that right?
Yeah.
But I think there's
whatever.
Yeah. So we're going to we'll leave it at 8:30 now, and we may post it for 8:45. So we'll leave it as it's currently posted at 8:30.